Welcome to this week's episode of the First Moves podcast. We'll be talking to Jens Thies, co-founder and chief science officer at Tempo Orthobiologics. We'll be talking about his journey from university graduate all the way to where he is today as an innovator with more than 20 years of experience under his belt and the inventor of more than 36 patents and counting. If you want to learn about the secrets of innovation and Jens's primary tip of focusing on the problem and falling in love with that and not your solution, then make sure you listen to this episode. We really enjoyed it, and we're sure that you will too. Thanks.
Welcome, Jens. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast today.
It's great
today.
To be here.
Could you maybe give a little bit of an introduction to who you are and what your life career has been a little bit?
Just sure. Shortly. So, as I was telling you guys earlier on, so I'm German by birth. I grew up in Scotland from the age of 9. So developed this accent quite quickly. Survival instinct, I think, kicked in. And I went to school and high school in Scotland. I went to university, did my PhD there. And during my PhD, I had a fantastic professor. Really, you know, one of those people, those handful of people who really, really makes a difference in your life. Professor Ian Cowie. He died just the year I did my TED Talk. And he was quite famous, quite well known, well regarded, spent his whole life in a wheelchair, most of his life in a wheelchair from the age of 27, but was really just an amazing guy, was really well regarded and had collaborated with Eindhoven University all around the world, but Eindhoven University was relevant for me. And I was going there to do some measurements for my PhD. And he said, oh, when you're there, DSM, you know, they'd like you to pop in for a chat. So typical me, you know, thinking, oh, people want to have a chat. Oh, but it's a company, I better put a shirt on. So I went for a chat and I walked into a room like this and there were three people on one side of the desk and a chair on the other. I said, this is not a chat, this is an interview, right? So that's the level of preparation, which is characteristic for me. You know, I generally go through life with a forward planning horizon around here, which is great, means everything's a surprise. Right. But then, yeah, so they offered me a postdoctoral project on kind of mechanical switches and molecular switches, which was very different from my PhD. And my professor had always given me the advice. He said, Jens, don't specialize. You're not a specialist. You're too fidgety. You're too impatient. You better to go out and do very, very different things. Every time you get a chance, do something very different. So I went from doing materials and optics to hardcore organic synthesis. And then I was quite young. I had my PhD at 25. Okay. So DSM sponsored me to go to the US to do another postdoc. And I went to Caltech in 2000. And then came back and did 23 years of industrial innovation. I'm sure we'll talk more about that. Until about 2 years ago. When I started out on my own. So that's pretty much the background.
Very cool. And I think your career then at DSM indeed translated into doing a lot of different things as the professor had kind of advised you to do.
Yeah, and it's also sometimes people, you know, there are certain conversations that you have. So I came back, be honest, I came back from Caltech and all of my colleagues were on their way to become professors, right? So all of the PhD students, senior PhD students, but also all the international postdocs, they're all professors at Dusseldorf, Stanford, NYU now, right? So I thought, oh, I'll go and do a couple of years of industrial research, I'll build up a bit of a network, and then I'll go and become a professor back in the UK. And that was nearly 26 years ago, you know? So that didn't happen because I got addicted to developing products. Mm. Found out I had a talent for it. And really just, you know, when you have an idea and you convert it into something real and you see a customer or a user engaging with the thing and engaging with it in exactly the way that you, well, maybe not exactly, but at least in some of the ways that you fantasize they would, right? That's really cool. And you just want to do it again and again and again. And I had the opportunity to do that.
So then what did that work look like at DSM, going and developing constantly new projects?
We're talking 2000 here. DSM was very different. Mm. And if you look at the history of DSM, it's evolved and changed quite a lot, right? But then it was still a pretty conservative, material-based Dutch company. It just bought Gist Procadis in Delft, which became the biotech center. It just picked up another couple of little businesses, usually changes by acquisition or merger. And it was quite conservative. And I remember talking to another person who really, in one conversation, really touched me. Yvonne Engele, a good friend of mine still, she was an HR person at the time. We were sitting at a conference. Her husband's a professor. He was at this conference with us, and we're sitting having a drink late at night, and she said, "So how's it going?" I said, "Well, you know, I'm finding it quite hard to fit in, if I'm honest." And she said, "What, fit in?" She said she wasn't involved in hiring me, but she'd seen my file, right? And she said, "We didn't hire you to fit in, Jens. We hired you because you knew you wouldn't." And I was like, really? And then I was like, that's not what they expect of me per se, right? So just be yourself. And I was really, all the way through, been really lucky to get projects and people to work with who share a kind of a passion and a joy of doing the crazy stuff. And it worked out. It worked out remarkably well. You know, in those 23 years, we developed 8 different products in 3 or 4 different industries, created whole new businesses that DSM then eventually divested for tens of millions, hundreds of millions of euros. So, yeah, it was a roller coaster. And like all good things come to an end, you know, that's just how it worked out.
So they gave you a lot of freedom to create what you want.
Yeah, looking back, yeah, man, a lot. I don't even know if the younger people at DSM today get as much freedom as we did. Mm. Yeah, because they knew they wanted to change it up a little bit. Mm. So you had corporate R&D. So, for example, engineering materials, so the stuff that goes in high-end applications in cars and electronics, like the little connector on your iPhone, you know, the little white bits between the metal? That's the science in that, you wouldn't believe, right? That's glass-filled polyamide. But to make that is really tricky. So that's what the businesses were good at, working with the companies, solving their problem. But the businesses weren't really good at creating completely new businesses, you know, that didn't fit neatly in everywhere. So DSM started this whole experiment with an innovation center and an incubator. I ended up in there with... First of all, with some anti-reflective stuff for laptops and screens. Mm-hmm. And then, we'll talk about that maybe later a bit more. But and then eventually taking that concept forward onto glass, to solar cells. And then somehow I made my way into the medical field.
Because that's what DSM is also known for, is their solar panel technology. So that is the glass you develop for the solar panels to be more efficient.
That's probably my... Still the biggest commercial and sociological success. I think it must be on more than 400 million square meters of solar cells around the world. And that's only DSM sales, but it was mercilessly ripped off. The technology was mercilessly ripped off in China. That was a crazy journey, that one. So, yeah, so I think that's still my biggest success story.
That was primarily in coatings, right? I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Okay.
Coatings, yeah.
Okay, cool.
The nice thing about the anti-reflective glass, though, and all the anti-reflective stuff, is it sold itself, especially internally, right? So I had this experience with the then CEO of DSM, Fike Siebesma, who I was still in contact with from time to time. And he was just becoming CEO. He wanted to meet the young innovators, right? So I'm in this, and I've got a couple of pieces of microscope slides. And one of them is a normal slide, and one of them's, I've got our stuff on it. Very first generation, right? Looked beautiful, right? So, and I passed it to him, and he went to touch it. And I said, "If I could, don't touch it." And he said, "What?" I said, "Please don't touch it." And he's looking at me, he's like, "What?" He said, and he actually said, "Jens, people don't often tell me what to do." I said, "Please don't touch it, it's very fragile." He said, what do you mean it's fragile? I said, "Well, that's why you're here." He said, "You know, you give me 1 year and 700,000 euros and I'll let you come back a year from now and I'll let you clean it." And he just reached across the table, and shook my hand and said, okay. Now, I was quite naive because I don't care too much.
That's
about...
That's such a great story. I'm sorry.
I didn't really understand how things worked, right, in big companies still. I mean, I didn't... I should have. I'd been there long enough. I'd been there 5 years already, right? So I thought FICA would just find somewhere at 1,000. He's a CEO, right? He's going to find something for 100,000. He's going to give it to my boss and say, make sure Jens gets his stuff. But he didn't. He turned around to my boss and said, I don't care which projects you have to stop, but Jens needs an extra 700,000, which made me about as popular as a fart in a spacesuit, you know,
yeah, I was gonna say,
amongst
yeah.
my colleagues. Yeah. But 9 months later, not even 12 months, 9 months later, he was back in the office and I passed him a piece of paper and I said, go on then.
Wow.
You know, but now we were better aligned because now I was going to ask for a couple of million to build a factory, the pilot plant and stuff. But yeah, that's the... Yeah. And it's always been stuff like that. I don't know. It comes out before I... Mm. You know, it comes out before I have a chance to really think, is this a smart thing to say often? But yeah. Most of the time, that's worked out quite well for me.
Yeah. I mean, I think that for me, at least the big lesson from starting out has been that authenticity breeds support.
Right.
So...
Right.
If you say what you think wholeheartedly and you don't try to frame it in a way that you think would sound nice.
Right, of course, yeah. You can't clean it yet. Don't look how beautiful it is. It's gorgeous, right?
Don't mess with my work.
And because it was literally invisible, I mean, some of our samples were so good you could only see the edges in certain light, right? You can only see the edge of the glass in certain lights. Then people would just be like freaked out, especially when you put it next to... normal glass, people would be like, how have you done that?
That's
you know?
So cool.
It's quite magic.
Yeah.
And so the project sold itself because everywhere I went, I was just like, what's this about?
Mm.
This is what it's about. Yeah. Oh, So if you reduce reflection, what does that mean? Well, you increase transmission.
Yeah.
If you increase transmission, does that make solar cells? Of course it does.
Yeah.
So for just putting a silly little 100 nanometer coating on glass, you can get an extra 3% efficiency relative.
Mm.
3% efficiency, 3 to 5
yeah.
out of your solar cell, right? Which is, you know, a big deal. Exactly.
But then with your authenticity, you want some support. But then what when you're in this like entrepreneurship world and you're innovating inside of a huge company like DSM, what kind of other support do you think that a company like that should give people like you in order to make sure that the innovation actually stays and that they are new and fresh and big ideas?
No, that's a good question. I think that one of the things, and I'm not saying we did it, you know, the structures that DSM set up at the time, I think were right for the time and for the transitions it was making and were well intended.
Mm.
I think sometimes it didn't work out, but that's maybe because, you know, you can create an incubator, you can create an ecosystem, but maybe you don't have exactly the right people to completely fill it, right? So I would say that incubation, having a place where people can, and I've been passionate about this throughout my career, I've been trying to keep that going, having a place where people can work on ideas or work on problems, and especially for big companies. So then you need two things. When I was younger, when I was your guys' age, I'm 52 now, just turned 52, I thought it was all about my ideas and my creativity because it's the only thing I'd ever been good at, right? I mean, I realized when I became a chemist that this is an area, apart from coming up with excuses, where I was creative and, you know, that worked for me. Mm. But really, one thing I realized later on is the most important moment is when somebody brings you the problem. Mm. So I would say fall in love with the problem, not the solution, because sometimes that's version number six, five or six, right? But the problem is, how do you make glass reflective in a way that's able to scale across millions and millions of square meters? Right. So it's got to be simple, right? That's the problem.
Mm.
Don't love your first idea more than the problem, because you might come to like, you know. And if you're still in love with the problem, you'll throw that away and you'll go again.
Yeah.
So I think if you can create an environment where the right-minded people, your creative, innovative people, can get together with people who bring problems from the real world and say, hey, we really need a solution for this, you know? And if you think about most of your origin stories, Unshackled, was because you became aware of the problem.
Yeah.
And once you became aware of the problem and its impact and the unmet need, you start thinking, well, what could you do about it, right?
Yeah.
But so it's not about the idea. It's about recognizing the problem, I think. And that took me a long time to be honest with myself about, to be.
And definitely also with the solution. We've gone through 11 different kinds of solutions and before we actually found something that works.
Yeah.
But that's the case of like throwing it away and then, okay, we go again.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because the problem is still there. This was just not the solution for
it. Try to iterate, fail fast.
Yeah.
Keep going, you know, which obviously doesn't work so well in the medical field because, you
know. Yeah.
But yeah.
That's a different story.
So I think that's the most important. Create an environment, create some freedom and realize it's not for everyone.
Mm.
You know, not everybody who joins a big R&D group like Philips or DSM is right for the amount of uncertainty and pivoting and stuff. Yeah. You know, sometimes I said to myself, why do I do this?
Mm.
Why do I do this to myself, right? Because you're only, even in the big company, even after some successes, I only ever thought that I was one big failure away from the end, right? Mm. You know, and yeah.
To me, it sounds like this falling in love with the problem, not the solution. That's something I've been trying to think about with the problem that I'm trying to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And I think falling in love with the problem, it helps break your assumptions around your solution faster. Do you have any ideas on like how you can build this kind of bullshit detector for your solutions? Because I think so many people, they have so many crazy wild ideas, but they don't ever actually test them.
Yes. No, test, get it in the hands of a user as fast as it possibly can. And don't lie to yourself. Mm. If you're not sleeping well because you don't think it's going to work, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen to your body. There's a brilliant book called Blink. Okay. Have you heard of this book called Blink?
No.
It's about, I read it at business school. It's about how your body, if you start to listen to it, picks up on signals, right? For example, marriage guidance counselors, they studied, have a 90% accurate reading of whether a relationship can be saved within the first 30 seconds.
Whoa.
They'll charge you for 10 sessions, right? But within 30 seconds, they know, oh no, this is, you know, you've not even said anything yet.
Oh.
Right? There's some great examples in that book. So if you, you know, try not to bullshit yourself and realize that the most precious thing you have is your time.
Mm.
And if you're wasting it on something that isn't going to fly, fuck it, man. Go do something else, you know, or try another approach.
Yep.
So if you're really, really lying in bed at night, you know, not sleeping because you think, oh, I'm not sure this is going to work, then you need to maybe really think about that.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe to take this fall in love with the problem a step further, after this, you started now Temporal Orthobiologics.
Yes.
Which is your startup that you're running now. How does that fall into the place with fall in love with the problem and not the solution?
That's a great question, Sebastian. So after my DSM time, there was a big reorganization and I left and I started consulting. So I do some innovation consulting. And I've been busy for the last year and a bit with a friend and business partner, Sanj, who I knew from a DSM project that we did together. And actually, this maybe comes from the other side. So Sanj, I met Sanj in a Ritz-Carlton hotel in California, one of these partnership meetings for pharma executives, right? And Sanj had a molecule for tissue adhesion, right? A really simple, right? So simple that when I saw it, I said, it's too good to be true. I mean, this isn't really a drug. It's a metabolism molecule. It's fuel, right? It's the stuff that bodybuilders have in their protein shakes. Mm. How does that, you know? And Sanj, to his credit, went off and got data. And then got more data. And then he got human data. And built a company around endometriosis. You know what that is?
Mm.
Yeah. So in most of your families and friends, you'll know somebody who's got endometriosis. And so basically the product that they have when the surgeon is in separating the tissue layers with a scalpel or with the scope, once the bleeding stops, they pump this molecule, this peptide, for 10 minutes or so, and the adhesions don't come back. And in normal surgery, in 20-30% of the times, the endometriosis comes back. So I'd spent a lot of time in the last 10-12 years in orthopedics. And I was pretty convinced that there, you know, that there were applications in orthopedics, in spine surgery, but mainly in knee surgery. And Sanj has always been very into, he's quite a fit guy, you know, and he's into sports. So we started thinking about sports medicine. Also because sports medicine is probably the most innovative aspect of orthopedics. Yeah, orthopedics is quite conservative, but the sports medicine, these guys who are trying to get an athlete back to full function will try stuff, yeah. Right? And Sanj is a brilliant networker. I mean, really incredible, the teams he can put together. And he met a chap called Riley Williams III, who is our, we wanted him as an advisor, right? And so we came with our story. This is the molecule. This is what we're thinking about. And he said, yeah, I like it a lot, but I don't want to be an advisor. I want to be a co-founder and I want to put in my own money. And because he's so well known and regarded in, I mean, he's FIFA's top guy at the World Cup next year. Eh? So right. In the World Cup in the US,
yeah,
he's the dude for sports medicine for the World Cup. Works for the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York, and has basketball teams and stuff that, you know, and famous sports people who are his patients. So again, the problem, I think that's where it, you know, is this a real problem that needs solving? Because sometimes you look around, we're trying to do something about arthrofibrosis. So the fibrosis that happens inside the knee as a result of surgery. So when you have surgery, I'm having shoulder surgery in 3 days' time. When you have surgery, there's a lot of processes that if they get a little bit out of control, a little bit too exaggerated, let's say, that you can have fibrosis and which can stop you having full range of motion.
Mm-hmm. In layman's terms, this is basically scar tissue.
Scar tissue, but yeah. Excessive scar tissue.
Right.
Yeah, in parts of the joint where we maybe even, you know, not directly near the trauma, quite close by. So this stops you having complete range of motion. I think a good example is Roger Federer. Mm. I think that's one of the reasons he retired, not because the surgery that he had to fix his ACL or whatever failed, but because the scar tissue stopped him having complete range of motion. And if you've got 1% difference and you're at that level, you're done, right? You know. So understanding that there was a real need there, and so we're just literally about to start in January. We'll build a lab and hire a few people and get some equipment in. And we're going to collaborate with a few companies that one of them I used to work for. And it's going to be really exciting.
Wow.
Really exciting.
Super interesting, because I'm just thinking right now, I used to do triathlon when I was younger.
Did you?
And then I switched to American football. And then I
would have loved to have played American football, man.
It was really fun until I had a scooter accident and I tore all my ligaments in my wrist.
Yeah.
And you can see now, that's my range of motion.
Yeah.
And on my other hand, it's like this.
Yeah, that's...
And that's pretty much because of scar tissue inside that it's formed.
Yeah.
So I can see if you're performing on a high level, this can be detrimental to your career.
I mean, that's...
Then you're done.
In tennis, that's... Yeah, it's already over, right? Because you can't turn your wrist over fast enough or... Yeah, so... and when then, you know, it's not only... You know, if the market was only elite athletes, we wouldn't get any investors, right? Because, you know, that's 0.1% of the population, right?
Yeah.
But there's all the weekend warriors... Yes. All the people who have scooter accidents.
The Sunday league football guys.
Football. And again, I think for one of the things that interested Sanj a lot was because he's built this whole company, which we call the Mothership, around women's health, and Temple Orthobiologics is a spin-off from the Mothership. So he's all about Temple Therapeutics is all about women's health. Mm. Women athletes are much more likely, especially female footballers, 6 times more likely to get an ACL injury that requires surgery than men.
Whoa.
Okay. Yeah, so, and the whole, I think, women's solution for women in orthopedics doesn't really, you know, they're smaller size knees and stuff and implants, but really, you know, thinking about women's needs in sports medicine. I think that's potentially also a new angle for us to exploit.
Yeah, very fair. But I think your very relaxed and easygoing nature almost underplays the impressive nature of this.
Yeah,
if you have a top, incredibly highly regarded surgeon on the team, someone like Sanj, who apparently is doing very cool things, and yourself also with an incredibly impressive background,
Thanks, but you're very
lax about it. I think, I just wanted to stress that because it sounds so casual, but it sounds like something that really has a lot of potential.
It's so weird, isn't it? Yeah. Things happen. You know how things happen in life and really how things come back as well, you know? So, I mean, it was over 12 years ago that I first met Sanj. But he set up his company in his first company, the mothership, as we call it, in Maastricht, right?
Well,
okay.
So he'd come back. He'd be here every year, you know, once or twice a year, and we'd bump out and go for a drink, and he'd show me his human data. And so when I finally left DSM, he said, hey, listen, you know, isn't this something we should maybe actually now just do, right? With a lot of stops and starts, you know, with a lot of regional investors that didn't work out in this region or that region. And eventually I have to say, once Riley came on board, then, you know, the believability, it just, you know, goes through the roof. And now things are looking a lot more solid.
Yeah.
But it also just goes to show, right, that a connection that you make 12 years ago doesn't have to do anything 12 years ago, but maybe like now 12 years down the line, it's super important that its connection was there, because otherwise you wouldn't have the spin-off company
absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So networking is just a networking, continuous thing.
Networking, but also, you know, doing little favors, you know, doing little favors and doing a little project here and just, you know, and just try not to be a dick, basically.
Yeah. But I think it also speaks volumes just in terms of collaboration. Right. I mean, that's something that you were speaking of earlier, your time of DSM. You know, you can have your own super creative ideas, but what if when people come to you with a problem
nothing.
And then you can think about it together?
So like I said, I did eight different products, 3-4 different industries, 36 patents.
Yeah.
I've never done anything in my life that's meaningful that I could have done on my own.
Absolutely.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. Yeah. And actually a lot of the things where we talk about scientific inventions, also observations in the lab, right? And not mine necessarily, somebody else. You know, I had a guy called Guido. The whole story started with a guy called Guido and I. We were working together on the very first generation of anti-reflective coatings. And he came with a sample that shouldn't have been anti-reflective, but it was, but ever so slightly. And I was like, no, it's not. And he said, yes, look, like it's definitely, you know, clear arts. I was like, no, it's not, man. He says, go and measure it. So he went and measured it. He came back. He said, this reflects 1% less. Glass reflects 8%.
Right.
So I went off and then from there to having the perfect system was 3 weeks.
Wow.
In a completely new way. But that's about his observation and us having the kind of relationship where he's like, no, man, it is. I'm going to show you. So goes off and measures it and comes back. He says, I told you so, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a lot of creative people sitting around saying, okay, now we understand how this works. How could we, why it's a little bit anti-reflective, how could we turbocharge it? And that was one of those rare things where the first experiment.
Mm.
And it's such a cool experiment as well, because you put normal glass in a tank and you dip it, or plastic, right? And as it comes out, the solvent evaporates. And we're all standing there together, and it just disappeared. When the solvent evaporated, it just disappeared in front of our eyes. And it was like, holy shit, that works. That really works.
Wow.
You know, and that was, you know, that was kind of the start of it. So, yeah, trying to be, just looking back, lucky to have the kind of people that you enjoy working with, where you can create a kind of a vibe around trying stuff out. And yeah, so I think I've always been really lucky with the people I've collaborated with.
And is there more of a intention in terms of the constellation that you guys are now having at Tempo Ortho Biologics? Is it you want to think about certain people? For example, you mentioned this idea of the ecosystem or the incubator, where you are sometimes just missing a constellation of people to actually bring it to fruition.
Yes, to a lesser extent, because what we're doing here in Temple is, I mean, the DSM situation was, you know, big company, big project starting from nothing. I mean, I know exactly how our product's going to look. Yeah, I know exactly how to make it. So we need to make it, prove it, and then validate it in preclinical and clinical studies. So our team's going to be quite small. We're going to outsource a lot of stuff, right? So, you know, we'll do projects with people like DSM. They'll create part of it. And our job will be much more project management and validation. So if we get results back from our partners, you say, you know, we created this prototype, it should do ABC, then me and my team will test that it actually does ABC, and then we can validate what the results really are. But I don't think we're going to, you know, I'd love to create another incubator with 20 people running around working on my crazy ideas, but maybe after we exit this one, there'll be enough funding for that. Who knows?
That'd
be
cool.
Yeah. So I think that's where it's kind of different.
Okay.
How do you go about in the early stages to find these people you're going to outsource the things to? Because you must trust the people you outsource things to as well, because it's quite important.
But it's mainly because they have unique technology.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the case of DSM, so after I did all the coating stuff, I moved to biomedical in the coatings area to begin with. And then was asked to be the global R&D manager for the drug delivery business. And there, again, another fantastic team of people, some really, really smart people. And we developed a whole new family of biomaterials for drug delivery. And they're unique, you know? And I know they're unique because I spent so many years with that team working together with them. So I know that they're very good for the kind of things that we imagine. And then there are other companies who can take materials and process them or shape them into particles or fabrics or whatever. So people who have, it's about competence and technology, really.
So you're also relying a lot on your past experiences with people outsourcing.
For sure. Absolutely. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to outsource it all, you know. But that's also quite a common model in the medical device and drug delivery kind of pharma space, you know, that you create a project team, but you know that these guys can formulate the drug, these guys can fill and finish and sterilize it or whatever, you know, and you basically sitting there managing a project. Quite a few companies I know, they never actually physically handle the product. I don't want to be that because I kind of need it, you know, that you need some, I need sometimes to hold it in my hand to make myself remember that it's actually real. So that's kind of the idea.
I just find it super interesting because it's really like the culmination of your career, like with Orthobiologics, sorry.
It's a bit of a mouthful. You could just say Temple. Temple. We'll get away with that.
Temple, it's everything you did from your PhD to working with DSM, everything just gets together now in a wholesome kind of way of like working together with them again and knowing where to go. And it just reminds me of some people, they always say like, oh, why should I go get a job for this company? Because that's not what I want to do later on. But you never know if but that's then, what's going to
again, remember I started by saying this is my forward planning horizon.
Yeah.
And we'll go through life like this. So it's great. Everything's a surprise. Who really has a plan? I mean, are there really people? My daughter, I suppose. My eldest daughter, she's got a plan. Total world domination. time she's 25. No, she really thinks about it. You know, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do that. I was doing a degree, and the professor who I was doing my final thesis in my last year of my degree, my undergraduate, said, hey, you're quite good at this. I've got money for a PhD. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, I had some like a pile like this of graduate recruitment forms, you know, tell us 12 ways in which you changed the world in a team environment and stuff. I mean, give me a break. I'm 21. I haven't changed the world. I haven't had a chance, you know? And so I had this pile of papers and had an offer of a 3-year PhD with a great professor in it. So towards the end of that, he comes and says, oh, you want to go to the Netherlands and speak to DSM? And next thing you're at Caltech. You know, I've been insanely lucky. And it's probably, that's probably one of the reasons I don't plan too much, because I kind of trust the universe will see me right in one way or another, you know?
But I think that's also a delimiting factor, because I know a lot of people who have a plan and they want to stick to that so strictly that if there comes an opportunity on the way, they say, no, that's not following my plan.
Yes, he says, oh no, that's deviating.
Yeah.
But this is essentially the life scale version of falling in love with the solution or the problem.
Right.
Yes.
Because you're stuck on the result.
Right.
And not on the way of actually maybe getting there.
Yeah. I think for me the most important thing is am I enjoying myself?
Mm.
And as importantly, am I learning? Right? Am I a geek? I mean, essentially I'm just a science geek, right? Who can talk a bit and has some creative ideas from time to time. But mainly I just love the science, you know? So as long as I'm learning and I'm having fun and I'm paying the mortgage and that there's maybe a bit of a dream aspect that I'm trying to realize as well, you know, that makes me jump out of bed in the morning to say, right, come on, let's do this, because if we pull this off, it'll be pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are the things that I think really drive me in this crazy journey.
I think that's good. That's not taking things too seriously.
No. But then there's a flip side as well that can get quite dark sometimes.
Fair. Maybe we can talk about the flip from being an entrepreneur to being an entrepreneur, what the main differences are.
The nice thing about being an entrepreneur is you get a monthly salary. And if the project, you know, I used to say to people sometimes in my DSM career, you are not your project. You're much more important than that. You know, because sometimes people would get very stressed out if their project was difficult and it wasn't working out. I said, you know, you are not your project. There's more to you and to your DSM career than this one project. I want you to go for it and I want you to try everything to make it work, but there's more to you than that. When you're an entrepreneur, that's it. You know, this is it. It's what you put everything into. And you really realize that, you know, there's a great blog out there from Guy Kawasaki. He said, the how long you survive equals cash in the bank divided by monthly cash burn. That's how long your company lives, right?
Yeah.
That's it, right?
Yeah.
And that's very different when there's a $10 billion company, or, you know, versus a startup that has a couple hundred thousand in the bank at the beginning of the year and a burn rate of X thousands of dollars or euros a month, right?
Yeah.
You know exactly how long you've got before you need new funding. You know when it is.
Yes.
Yeah. I think you already mentioned the date.
Yeah. And started, not exactly right? When I'm running out.
Yeah. So that's it. No, that whole blog is really funny. You should read it.
Okay.
You should read it.
It's obviously a very busy life as well, working for DSM in a position like this of making products, and there's also pressure on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a bit more pressure even when you go for your startup, because then there's no one who actually pays you a monthly salary immediately. And a big thing in entrepreneurship, also we talked about this as well, it's burnout. You sometimes think I'm at risk for it at the moment because I'm working extreme hours at the moment. But how do you deal with that? How do you make sure that you take the time off that you need to take off to kind of regenerate again?
I think I'm pretty lucky that I'm a pretty high energy person naturally. I do like to sleep, and I could sleep for Scotland. Like if sleeping was an Olympic discipline, you know, I could sleep. It drives my wife crazy. I can sleep anywhere. You know, we've got 20 minutes on the train. Or, you know, so I think that's fun. Three kids, really, and. I don't know if it's by I don't think it's even by design, but I think generally when I'm doing something, I do it pretty not focusedly, but that's where my mind is and where my emotions are. So when I'm a dad, when I'm standing on the football pitch or the hockey pitch watching my kids play football or hockey, that's where I am. Yeah. And these things are a great distraction. And it's, you know, it's a really good point. But I think also in a lot of burnouts that, you know, and I've, you know, obviously at my age, been around a fair few people who've had them, it's rarely only work. Mm. Yeah, there are people, relationship issues, family issues, depression, mental health, whatever, right? All of which can happen to any one of us, and nobody's immune to that. But it's rarely only work. And then if your work sucks, that's the straw that breaks the camel's back, you know, then because I mean, it's such a, even if it's only a 40 hour a week, which in our business, it's not, right? But it's such a big part of your life that if it's not giving you energy, if you're not enjoying it, then I think that can be the trigger, you know, so you need to be careful.
Maybe it's then also time to look for something else if it's really not enjoyable. Obviously, there's going to be days where you're like, oh, this job, nah, this I don't like. This task, just don't like it. I have to get through it.
I mean, so months.
Months sometimes as well. Yes. But if it doesn't end at some point,
all then the administrative maybe that's the point. Stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's horrible.
I hate it.
Yeah, no, it's...
I hate it. The tax and the invoices and the banking and all, I hate it, right? Yeah. But, you know, it's a necessary evil. So you have to do it. Now, if it was only that...
Yeah.
You know, then wow, it would kill me, but thankfully it isn't. Yeah. You know, and one of the nice things about doing the consultancy as well is that I have a lot of clients from really small startups. Sometimes venture capital ask me to do some due diligence work for them. I've done quite a lot of work with the Dutch Arthritis Association. Mm-hmm. They're awesome, really, really great charity. But then again, it's varied. You know, and even when we go now into next year where Temple will be my major focus, I will keep one foot or half a foot in the consulting game, because it creates some some intellectual kind of other things to think about, other problems, you know, to fall in love with. But never at the expense of Temple. That's going to be the most important thing.
And then how does that, do you think, relate to this idea of imposter syndrome, of going into a new space? And, I mean, constantly you're dealing with new problems, new things coming up.
Imposter syndrome is brilliant. I think so it's a funny story, right? So at DSM, we used to have this leadership meeting for the R&D leadership in the medical business. And... you know, at the beginning, everybody did a small talk, right? And even small talk became like an agenda item, like checking in, you know, and anybody got anything interesting or anything they want to miss, you know, we're checking in. And there was the HR person who came in and said, I've just read this article that, you know, it was a fairly big number. It's close to 50%, let's say 45. So it doesn't really matter what the number was, but she said, 45% of American managers have imposter syndrome. I think that's appalling. Because, you know, that means there's 45% of people out there who don't think they're qualified to do the job. And I just said, wait a minute, it's the other 55 you've got to worry about. Yeah. It's the other 55 you have to worry about. That's where your sociopaths are. That's where the people who break the business are. That's where the arrogance not to listen to anybody else sits. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the 45% of the people who have some empathetic self-doubt and think, shit, am I really good? I was the lead scientist for biomedical. There were 90 other scientists, right? Brilliant people, double PhDs and stuff, right? Mm. If I don't have imposter syndrome when I represent them, there's something wrong with me. Right. So I think it's, you know, if it's not destructive, it's great. It's actually, I think it's a positive thing because it keeps you humble. And if you're humble, then you're authentic. And that makes people, you know, want to work with you. If you go in like you know everything. Maybe that's okay in surgery, in the medical space. And like, you know, I don't want my neurosurgeon to have imposter syndrome. Okay, you know what I mean? I think he'd be fairly confident if he feels he's absolutely on the top of his game or her game. But for the rest of us, I think it's a positive thing in some ways, a lot of ways. Yeah,
I agree, for sure. That was also one of the first lessons I had, is I was moving into the first year of working full time for myself, and I was like,
what am I doing?
I have what the fuck, dude? I'm this old. I'm trying to do this. Makes no sense, first of all. And then I brought it up in a conversation with someone who managed like 2,500 people under him.
Yeah.
And I was like, how do you, like, I just feel like I can't do it. I feel like, how do I lead people? My team is like 6, you're running 2,500. Like, I just can't get over this idea of, I don't know if I can do this or not.
Yeah, yeah.
Or what am I doing wrong? Or am I good enough?
What do the people think, right?
Yeah.
But you know the thing is, you're authentic.
Yeah.
And you're open about it. Mm. So even if the 6 people you're working for, you know, you say, hey, guys, you know, sometimes
yep.
I find it hard to think, you know, why on earth
yep.
is this a position that I have, right?
Yep.
Then that's a superpower.
Yeah.
I think that's a superpower.
Exactly. And he said the moment that goes away, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, cool. And then the frame switched, and I was like, all right, it's a strength.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as it doesn't indeed impede exactly. my decision making.
As long as you don't freeze, don't make decisions because you think you're not, you know.
Yeah.
But and consult people, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's again falling in love with the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Like in some sense, because you're testing your assumptions. You're not fixated on, I need to fit into this box to be exactly what
exactly.
I need to be.
Exactly. And this is the model of a leader.
Mm.
Yeah? There is no model of a leader. I've met hundreds in my career, and I've met them with every single different Myers-Briggs personality type that there is, right? But the ones that are good are the ones that are authentic and the ones that have enough ability and maybe confidence to self-reflect and you know. So I will tell people that I work with what I'm not good at and what really doesn't get, you know, God, administration, you know, I'll try and get that contract to you today, but of knowing me, it might be Monday, you know, and these kinds of things. I think that's important.
Yeah.
But it's also kind of like if you don't have a little bit of imposter syndrome, you can't grow anymore.
No.
Because if you feel like you're the best at this job,
and you're already there.
Then you're there.
Yeah.
And there's no more getting better or anything like this. No. So there's no point in trying to get better at some point either. So I think as an entrepreneur, at least for this, I can always get better at it.
Yes. You're good enough.
Yeah, I'm good enough, but I can get better.
But you're also, there's a British word, blagging it a little bit. Like, you know, you're also just, how do I explain blagging
it? Is it like winging it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You're winging it, right? Yeah. And you have to have enough confidence in yourself to say, okay, this is me winging it, but you know, it'll be okay, right?
Okay, yeah.
And realize that there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, especially when you're doing things that nobody's done before, right? And, you know, I'm sure every one of these podcasts, every innovation, every venture is different, has different challenges, there's common themes for sure. Yeah. So you're going to end up facing unique challenges that nobody else ever has. So there are 8 other billion imposters possible for that problem that you're facing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the role of luck as well. Because we talked a little bit like that you don't have a big plan. So there's a little bit of luck, I guess, involved in thing. But how do you see luck as like an extent to attribute to your success in your career?
I think luck's only luck if you recognize it. Right? So you're in a lucky situation. But if you recognize it as, wow, that's lucky. It's like there's a famous quote from Isaac Asimov, you know, the author, wrote a lot of science fiction books, I, Robot, and another bunch of loads, very prolific guy. It was a physical organic chemist. But he always said the most powerful words in science isn't eureka, it's that's odd. Right? That's odd. You know, Guido.
Yeah.
That's odd.
Yeah.
Right? And the luck is Guido doing that, but there's also how you respond to how you recognize those lucky moments and then go for it. Right? Mm. And stick your neck out a little bit when luck comes along.
Yeah.
You know, stick your neck out and say, "All right, let's give it a shot." I think that's for me. That's probably looking back. It's all been luck, but when luck presents itself, then stick your neck out and go for it. Mm. You know,
you have to grab it.
Don't
with both hands.
Don't waste the opportunity when it presents itself. I mean, nothing. I mean, if I look back, nothing. I've never really felt like I've been unlucky in that regard. You know. Interesting.
Then what I'm just curious about your reaction to this quote then. Luck is what happens when preparation meets opportunity.
Yeah, I could buy that. For sure. Preparation? Yes. Yeah. Preparation, like awareness of the problem. Yeah. There's a quote from Bob Rice I used in my presentation here at that pitching night. Mm-hmm. Bob Rice is a serial entrepreneur from the US. And it's because I did a DSM, again, great, paid for me to do a master's. So I did a master's in business innovation. It was a great master's program. Everybody on the program had to have an internal venture or a startup. So there were guys from Philips, but that were working as entrepreneurs within Philips in a little Skunk Works team, right? Or me. And there were guys, now two or three of them are companies now. You know, Zeltis? Have you guys heard of Zeltis?
No.
It's a company in Eindhoven. They make heart valves for kids and other cardiovascular devices. Really cool. I went to business school with the CTO, right? There's another company called IME Technologies. They're now called Vivolta, who do this cool technology called electrospinning for making fabrics for implants. I went to business school with them. Raymond was in my... Should maybe have those guys on.
That'd be cool.
But so everybody had to have their own thing, and we're all scientists, right? And we realized at one point we were sitting there saying, well, there's actually a scientific definition of innovation or entrepreneurship. There, And the Bob Rice one, I think, is the one that speaks to me the most. Let's see if I can remember it. Entrepreneurship is the recognition and pursuit of opportunity without regards to the resources you currently control. Isn't that great?
Yeah, it's nice.
Isn't that great? So the recognition and pursuit. So recognize it and go for it. And don't worry about what it's going to take. Because if you spend all your time thinking about what it's going to take, you spend all your time planning. You know, if you imagine you were trying to create Apple.
Yeah.
Imagine you said to Steve Jobs, can you give me the whole plant to get to $1 trillion company, please? No, you would have been completely overwhelmed. But no, it's about the first computer, the first mouse, the first steps along the way. Yeah. So... You know, without regards to the resources that you currently control.
Yeah.
Because you were thinking about your cash in the bank divided by monthly cash burn equals a date, right? And yeah, you need to do something about that. But if that's the only thing you're worried about, you're not going to spend your time developing the product or doing the other important stuff that you need to do.
Yeah, fair. So Jens, you actually gave a TED talk as well.
TEDx, yeah.
Mr. Yeah, TEDx, yeah. 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
4 days, 5 days before my daughter was born.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so like, it was, it's a little bit like bungee jumping. Like, I'm glad I did it, but I don't need to do it again.
What, terrifying.
Utterly terrifying. And I love public speaking. Right. I really do.
Yeah.
You know, I love the sound of my own voice. Right? And so, you know, I was joking, I can go to somebody's wedding that I hardly know and I'll give a speech, right?
Yeah.
But... Then I realized that most of the time I give a talk, you're given a talk and you're backed up by all the beautiful scientific data that your colleagues and your teammates created. So it's not about me. It's about the science. It's about the thing. And okay, a bit of my personality might come across, but TED Talk, it's just Jens. And that was terrifying, man. And, you know, my wife was heavily pregnant and I was obsessed. And she's like, oh, my God, just let it be over. Let it be over, right? Because I was obsessed. I was like, oh, and I'd have an idea, and I'd change, and, you know, and it was okay. It wasn't even great. I think it's okay. I'm quite happy with it.
It was a good talk.
I thought it was a great talk,
thanks,
to be honest.
Thanks, guys. Some things I'd like to change if I got a chance to do it, but I will never do it again. But what was really interesting on the day, the people who talked before me in that same session were some really, really heavy subjects. Guy who'd grown up with a brother who was schizophrenic, became a professor of psychology. Guy, you remember that house in Bangladesh, the place where they used to make all the clothes? Yeah, so sweatshop essentially that collapsed, killing as many people as in 9/11 in the Twin Towers. And the photographer who was there on the day is called Ismail. He's now really famous, really huge. And he gave this picture. He walked around. He took pictures of all the H&M shops and stuff around Maastricht. And then he had one picture, which was a I think it was an Esprit label in a hand coming out of the rubble that was still, you know. And it was, and so these people were before me, and so I come out on the stage and make my first little joke about my wife being pregnant and my phone being switched on, and 900 people laughed. Mm. And I remember it hitting me, like physically, like wind, mm. like coming off the audience, and I thought, shit, this could be all right. I think this is going to be okay. Right? And then I relaxed into it a little bit. And
knowing yeah, that, I want to see it again and see yeah. if you can see your physical
you will change. And also, I didn't know that the mic was on. So when I walked out and I saw there's 500 people there, 400 people up there, there's 900 people, you think, wow. And I say, wow.
Yeah.
That's the first thing, because I didn't think the mic was on yet.
Yeah, right.
So I said, that was more to myself. But yeah, it was, you know, and it's really something that I believe, right, that there, you know, the way the universities and stuff teach science, that's important.
Mm.
But do we value the people who connect enough?
Mm.
And are companies and educational institutions, it's a little bit like, you know, UCM, mm. I think, is in, within that mold, right? The idea of mm-hmm. really having a very broad, varied educational experience. But yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering, so it's this idea indeed of there's more room in between, speaking that in between expert knowledge and ideas and this hyper-specialization.
Yes.
That the place that we can leverage to solve the world's issues is in between those
right.
specialists.
Exactly, because as you go deeper and deeper, there's less of it.
Exactly.
Right, until yeah. eventually you become the world expert in quantum physics.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's quite a few of those.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah.
So, you know, eventually you become the world expert at nothing,
mm.
right? Because mm. if you just get down to the singularity, so right? Mm. Whereas the problems, the space in between those subjects, right? Mm. And I've always found it to be, that's one of the reasons I really like the medical field from a material. So I'm a material scientist. I did polymer science and optics. But to be, at the you know, the interface between materials and the body,
mm.
yeah, that's implants, biomaterials. That's fascinating. So, and I think there's no, actually, when I thought about it afterwards, looking back at the TED talk, I don't think there's an area in that I've come across that is such a good example as biomedical engineering. Because if you're really making medical devices, you have to understand the medical stuff. Sorry, you have to understand the biology. You have to, you know, there's so many different disciplines that you have to bring together that's a really good example of this idea of the room in between.
Yeah. Would you change anything about the idea, or has your thinking around it developed?
This is going to sound bad, but I'm not as hopeful as I was.
Mm.
I'm not. At the time I was, maybe that's just getting old, but I really did think still that, you know, that if we get our shit together, we've got so much, humanity has so much talent, so much brain, right? That if we get our shit together, we have some success stories.
Mm.
But I look at the political environment, and I look at the, you know, I look at the world that I think our children are going to grow up in. Yeah, it's I'm not as optimistic as I was, which is tough because I'm intrinsically a very optimistic person. But I think I would struggle to give the same talk today because I'm not as optimistic about it, you know?
Yep.
Although you could say that if we don't collaborate and we don't bring disciplines together, we've got zero chance. But even just the brains and bringing those collaborations together without the political will to really solve the world's problems in a way that might even make you slightly poorer in the short term. If we don't solve that problem, then, you know, you can collaborate all you want.
But maybe going from that into what's the future for you look like then? Like, What's the dream? What's your next 5 to 10 year plan?
The dream is we want to get the Temple Orthobiologics moving off the ground. We want to get the first product into human clinical trials as quickly and as safely, obviously, as possible. And then develop, and hopefully by then we'll have created value, and investors will see that we're living up to what we promise, and then maybe grow the team and develop some more products, because, you know, in medical this is, we've talked about it for your venture. There's a thing called design freeze. After that, I'm basically done. You know, when the design's frozen and it's being validated that it's safe and efficacious in preclinical, say, animal studies or human clinical studies,
right,
you don't change it anymore. First of all, the FDA and the regulators won't accept that. And secondly, it's if you change it, you have to go back and repeat everything again, right? So you really try and make sure that when we're ready for our like pivotal preclinical study, that that's it. We're not going to change anything now. And the stuff that comes after there is proving that it's safe, proving that you've got your manufacturing and your supply chain under control, proving. But the creative part, which I'm good at, is over at that point. So my dream is get to that point, hopefully convince the investors that there's more to come, and then go back to the beginning and do another one, do another product, maybe based on the same technology, for a different indication, for a different part of the body. You know, that's... build a team, do research, have fun.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Never ending.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, at some point.
Of course.
At some point.
Of course. Yeah. But it's something that you could keep, like, it's a process because you're so process focused.
I just don't know how to do anything else.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I just don't, I really don't, you know, and I think it's again, going back to luck. I mean, lucky that my post-DSM time has allowed me to create or kind of blunder into a situation where I can keep doing the only thing I really know how to do.
So Jens, we have this closing tradition on the podcast where we ask our guests to bring an object or item of great value to them personally or for their career. What did you bring for us today?
I brought two things, but they're related. So let me put that there. And so remember earlier on we were talking about Guido and his observation?
Yeah.
So that was my first real success story. And we built this technology we called OptoClear. It was for laptops and TV screens and stuff. And we had it design freeze, I would say, yeah, pretty much. And I was traveling all over Asia. I was going to Korea, Taiwan, Japan, giving presentations, because that's where the display industry was, right? About this technology. And we had a, DSM had a really strange construction where we had a joint venture in Japan, but our partner in the joint venture was a competitor outside of Japan. Anyway, they brought the display technology into the joint venture. And we brought fiber optic cables technology, which I had nothing to do with. But somebody said, hey, Jens, you've got a background in optics, and couldn't you do something anti-reflective so that we, you know, it was a more balanced partnership? And then Guido, the observation, it led to. So anyway, back in the day, in DSM, when you had a patent, a US patent, you would have to sign it over to the company for the value of $1, right? And in those days, you would get a little envelope with a dollar bill in it, right? I don't know what happened. It stopped at some point. I wonder if they put an extra year dollar or equivalent on my pay package when, because I signed over 30 of these, right? So this one says here, OptoClear patent transfer, because I thought this might be quite an important one, because we sold the technology. We hadn't even hit the market yet. 27 million.
Wow.
Yeah. And there were some good business guys who'd built some other stuff, but I mean, it's all bundled together. We sold it for 27 million, which that year was, I think, 2 or 3% of the total profitability of DSM, which was a company of 20 odd thousand people, and we did that. We did 3% with a team of three or four, right?
You know, speak about leverage.
With also, you have to realize these coatings are so thin that a kilo can make hundreds of, you know, kilometers. Yeah, so three guys making 20, you know, so yeah, you can see that one there. It says on the, I'd written on it at the time, so. That's on my whiteboard.
Cool.
Yeah?
That's really cool.
You should show it to the camera. Maybe it'll focus.
And the internal number was 21556. I still remember it.
Can we show that, actually?
Yeah, sure. Okay, sure. That's okay. Just an internal patent, like, document number.
That's very cool.
Yeah, so I
thank you for showing that.
And that led to this. So this that led to, that was the whole start of the...
You said green show up better, right?
Yeah.
Maybe the green dollar bill might even work.
The green
of
the dollar.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's try. So if I just hold that up...
Yeah.
How does that look on the camera?
can see it, but I think we need to get the camera straight onto it to see the difference. You can see very blue in the middle.
Very blue.
Yeah.
Well, maybe I need to hold it at a different angle so you don't get the bright reflection from the lights. Yeah, so this is it. You know, when it's at its best, people
just walk
knock it and touch it and stuff. So yeah, this led to the glass, but with a lot of iterations, because the dollar technology was organic.
Mm.
It was UV curable, so you put it on, you hit it with light, and it was fixed.
Mm.
And we tried putting that on glass, and I went to a glass company, and the guy took his pen, his Parker pen, you know, and just ran it over, and it just came right off.
Yeah.
And he said, come back when it's as hard as glass.
Wow.
So, okay, that's going to be challenging. But yeah, so those are really the things that, you know, those are the things that really kickstarted my career. And brought me into the medical field, because from this kind of idea, I developed a medical coating,
mm-hmm.
and from there into the whole medical thing. So these are the two things I always like to show and to look at. My house, the first application for this was actually in art glass,
mm-hmm.
so for picture framing. So half of the pictures in my house have my glass on. You know, I've got a nice picture of photograph of Einstein that's framed in this stuff. And yeah. So these are things that mean something to me in my innovation journey.
That's very cool.
It's also interesting that the fact that you've been working on these coatings, and it's something that the general population doesn't know about, that there's a tiny, tiny coating like this on the solar panels.
110.
For relevance, how thick is that? Like, for something that we might know.
Human hair is 50 microns, so 5,000th.
A 5,000th of a human hair?
Yes.
Holy crap.
Okay,
there's a lot of science, there's a lot of technology in that. Basically, the way it works is you have little tiny bubbles. In the coating is porous, because you want to hit the refractive index of the square root of glass. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So glass is 1.5.
Mm-hmm.
Square root of 1.5 is 1.225.
Mm-hmm.
And the lowest refractive index of any natural material is magnesium fluoride, which I think is 1.367 or something. So you can't get down to 1.22 without putting air into the coating, which is one by definition. So if you look at that 100 nanometers and you break it open, inside it looks like a honeycomb. It's got bubbles, little nano bubbles all the way through it.
Tiny bubbles of air.
Tiny bubbles of air.
Because you would expect that to distort it, but because they're so small.
They're so small, the light doesn't see it.
Yeah, exactly. Because
they're about 60 nanometers in size, 80 nanometers in size.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It is very
sometimes
cool.
Sometimes I forget how cool it was.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. Well, Jens, it's been a real pleasure.
I've really enjoyed it, guys. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. For coming.
And I think it's a really cool thing that you're doing.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, we enjoy it.
Thank you for listening to our episode. If you want to connect with our guest personally, then give us a follow on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram at First Moves Podcast. And lastly, we ask you to leave a review. This will enable us to bring better guests on board and give you better content in the future. Have a nice day.